720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always grateful to you for sharing part of your Saturday afternoon with me. So today on the show, we're going to talk about lots and lots of stuff, including a company that is trying, or at least aiming anyway, at putting high-speed internet in every place on Earth through a series of satellites. We're going to take a look at Elizabeth Warren's 2005 personal finance advice book and how that holds up right now. And we're going to take a look at the Lincoln Yard story that many of us have been following this week. Lots of quick developments there and big ones at that. So we're going to be talking about that. But right now, we're joined by Ali Marati, reporter at Chicago Tribune, who is a regular contributor to this program. And she wrote about the flourishing marijuana industry in Illinois and how, at this point, most of its proprietors, it's a fairly homogenous industry. And some people are looking to shake that up. Ali, welcome to the program. Always a pleasure to have you with us.
Hey, Amy. Thanks for having me.
So talk us through this. This is a really fascinating story. And for those of you who follow me on social media, I'm going to tweet it out after the program so you can read it for yourself. But talk us through the basics, because it is a really interesting one that at this moment, as this is still a fairly young industry in Illinois, for it to be coming up in such a big way.
Yeah, so Illinois has a medical marijuana program right now that's been slowly growing over the past few years. Marijuana first went on sale in late 2015, so it's still a pretty young industry. And now the lawmakers are talking about legalizing recreational marijuana. Governor J.B. Pritzker supports it. There are a couple of different lawmakers that are drafting a bill now. And one of the things that they want to include is basically provisions in the bill that would allow more minorities to participate in the industry. Because right now, as you said, a lot of the owners of these companies that are growing here in Illinois, and also they've expanded nationally as well, are mostly white owners. And there's a lot of reasons for that.
What are a few of them? Is it a matter of people that have access, people who are funding people closely in their network, or what is that about?
Yeah, so to even apply to own, so we have two different kinds of business licenses here, one to grow and process marijuana and one to sell it. And to even apply for licenses to open either one of those businesses, there were thousands of dollars in application fees. And then on top of that, these business owners had to come up with hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions of dollars, to get these facilities up and running, to pay permit fees, whatever they had to do. And the problem is that, unlike a normal business, in this industry, they had to put up their own capital and raise their own money, because you can't just go to a bank, because most banks don't give loans out to marijuana companies because it's still illegal federally. So that was one of the issues, is the capital. A lot of people were, had issue accessing the industry because of that. And then there are other issues, too, that they're looking to address with this new law that they're working on now. Some of it would be, just training people in the industry, because now we already have an industry up and running. Those companies have an advantage, right, because they've worked out the kinks. They know how to grow the plant, which is still legal for normal people to learn how to grow, in their apartment or whatever. So there's just some barriers of entry there that need to be lowered.
And so what's proposed is some rather, systemic ways of thinking through making this a more inclusive industry. You talked with a couple of businesses in particular, or business owners in particular, that were kind of on the forefront. What did you learn from these particular businesses?
Yeah, so there are companies in Illinois, marijuana companies, that already have launched some programs. Some of them are working to just make sure they're hiring from the communities that they're in and make sure their workforce is representative of those communities, and then sort of hire up, train them, and, make sure that some minorities that they've hired get into leadership roles. And then there are others that are working to train people that want to get into the industry so that they can be ready when the state does legalize recreational use and does issue more licenses. They can be ready to apply. It's not like they're starting from scratch. Maybe they've already raised capital. Maybe they already understand what they're going to need to do to even just start filling out an application. Because the first time around, that process was pretty complicated. There are consultants that were hired, lawyers that were hired, that sort of thing. And then I think they only had 90 days to get an application together. So it's sort of, a sprint, and you have to be ready for that.
And be ready to fund it with all the steps involved with there, too. And so what kind of timelines are we looking at as far as this proposal and even just pushing forward with recreational marijuana in general?
Yeah, so the lawmakers are drafting the bill now, and they're hoping to have it passed by the end of May, which is when their session ends and breaks for a few weeks in the summer. And then I've heard that products probably wouldn't be available until 2020 at least. I'm not exactly sure what the timeline would look like on that. It does take a couple years typically to roll out one of these programs. But other states that have had a medical program and gone to the recreational side of things usually incorporate the growers that they already have operational. And the growers that we have here in Illinois would be able to supply a recreational market, you know, for at least the first couple of years. There was, the lawmakers did a demand study and took a look at that because they do already have those operations up and running. They have additional capacity. So that is something that, you know, could move things along quicker, but we would just have to see how long it took the bill to get passed.
Indeed, and we will keep turning to you for the latest as it continues to unfold. Thank you so much, Ali Marotti, reporter at Chicago Tribune. Appreciate you.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about a company that plans to bring high-speed internet to every single place on Earth with a series of satellites that are smaller, closer to Earth, hopefully would work better. I don't know. We're going to take a look back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Lots to do on the program still. We are joined now by Ashley Vance, writer for Bloomberg Business Week and author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Ashley wrote about OneWeb, a company that says they plan to bring high-speed internet to every place on Earth with a series of satellites that are a little smaller, a little bit closer to Earth than the ones that we currently rely on for internet data, which, you know what, that sounds pretty good to me. So let's learn more. Ashley, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So talk to us about OneWeb, this company, and what their plan is. It seems like quite ambitious, but also rather exciting. Is it looking likely to work?
Yeah, it is. It's very ambitious, that's for sure. You know, today there's still about 3 billion people that don't get high-speed internet because they can't be reached by fiber optic cables. And so this company, OneWeb, came up with an idea that plays off a lot of advances in technology that have happened over the last 10 or 15 years, and that's basically to create a space internet that gets delivered by around 2,000 satellites surrounding the Earth at all times, and you know, people would have these low-cost antennas that would be able to pull this signal down. And so this would be kind of like the first time in human history when the internet was everywhere.
Which, as you note in this story, which for those of you who follow me on Twitter, I'm going to tweet it out after the program so you can read it for yourselves. But as you note in the story, like, that would mean you could go to the top of Mount Everest and post on Instagram. You could, you know, do a lot of things where normally you take the picture, post it later kind of things. But it also to me, that has implications for the way rescue operations work, the way, you know, exploration of remote areas. There's a lot at stake there of pulling this off.
Absolutely, yeah. So this company, I mean, it has this twofold mission. So one is that these 3 billion people that don't have high speed internet today, they tend to be in pretty remote and poor locations. And so, you know, the good side of all this is that you'd be able to buy a cheap antenna and put it on a school or a hospital or, like you said, sort of emergency services facility, and then get everything that the internet brings with it. You know, for better or for worse,
right.
for everybody else, it means that you would, you know, all those vacations that you take to try and get away from the internet and everything, those would be over, because whether you're on Mount Everest or out in the ocean or even just escaping on a plane, if you're lucky enough for few hours, you'd be able to get the internet now as well.
Right. And so what kind of timeline is this company looking at?
It's gone a little bit slower. You know, even though they originally thought they're about a year behind schedule. So I just went to this rocket launch in French Guiana, where this European company sent up the first 6 satellites. And so that's 6 of 1,980 that they're planning to put up over the next, I'd say, 3 to 5 years. And so the service should start in a really limited way at the end of this year and be built out next year. But this is something that's going to roll out over, you could say, the next 2 to 6 years. And then along with OneWeb, Elon Musk's SpaceX rocket company. They want to build a rival space internet, and there's a couple other companies that are trying to do this as well.
But it seems like OneWeb has the lead here. And as you note in the story, it's not all business. It seems like there's some interpersonal angst and tension here between the OneWeb founder, Greg Weiler, and Elon Musk, as you mentioned.
Yeah, I've been covering the story for a long time. So I first, Greg first started talking about this in 2012. And so I've been following it all the way back to that point, and he and Elon used to be friends. They hung out at each other's houses, and Greg kind of presented this plan for this space internet to Elon, and at one point they were going to partner and do this together and maybe have Google fund a big part of the project. And then one day Greg woke up and he found out that Elon was doing his own space internet, and so they've now they're rivals, and Greg is pretty upset about it, and Elon doesn't always have the best things to say about Greg either.
Well, I feel like that's, stealing an idea might just spoil a friendship if you feel like someone's ripped off your idea. For sure, I could see how that
especially
would.
Especially when it's...
What's that?
The space internet,
Yeah.
Especially when it's the space internet.
Especially when the stakes are this kind of, high, quite literally very high stakes that reach into space. I could see that being an issue. So when people are kind of in a broader way, because you have looked at this topic for so long and been following this for such a long time, in a broader way, when people talk about space exploration and the things SpaceX are doing and the things OneWeb is doing and the idea of this internet being within reach in this way, what's most often misunderstood or what's maybe the part of the narrative that gets left out the most, in your opinion?
Yeah, it's a great question. This is something that I'm writing about a lot, and I think a lot of people are missing. We're at this moment in time where the price of rocket launches is coming way down. The satellites have gotten much smaller and cheaper than they used to be. And so we're on this cusp of, I always think of it as building kind of a computing shell that's around the Earth. So today there's about 1,500 satellites going around the Earth. And if you look at the business plans for a ton of these satellite companies, that number's meant to go from 1,500 to about 20,000 to 30,000 in the next 5 years. And so I don't think that the average public is aware that, there's this thousands and thousands of satellites coming to provide internet service, to take pictures of every spot on the Earth every day, to do all kinds of new science experiments in space. And so, there's this brand new economy that's being built in what they call low Earth orbit, about 750 miles above the Earth. And it's happening really quick, and most people are not paying attention to this.
That's so fascinating. I think you're right. And the idea that that's all within reach within 5 years, that's pretty significant. What other implications does that have? Like, once we reach this capability, we're 20 to 30,000 satellites, what else is at stake there? Or what other things do you see kind of starting to move or pop at that point?
I mean, there's a lot of pros and cons to all this. We're moving to a much more connected, much more modern age. And so when we think about things like self-driving cars and drones and the proliferation of these types of things, the only way that's going to happen is if basically the Earth is blanketed with this internet service, this connection that's always on. So that's one thing that's going to facilitate this next era, really, in humanity. And then, all the imaging stuff that I was talking about, these taking pictures of every spot on the Earth, you can track what's happening to rainforest. You can track what's happening to refugees that are moving around the world. You can track commerce, all the boats that are going everywhere, all the oil that's being produced. And so I also think of this as sort of like this Google from space. We're building a system, a computing system, where essentially we'll be able to ask much more detailed questions about what's happening on Earth. And at the moment, I mean, all this stuff has all this promise, and it's really interesting. Nobody's proven out, really, that there's a business case for all this stuff yet. Like, we can do it, but it's expensive, and so it's just not clear kind of what the money... what's really going to drive a lot of money. But we are on the cusp of a very interesting time.
Yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much for joining us today to talk about this. And it sounds, I know you mentioned earlier that you were there on the edge of the Amazon rainforest watching these satellite launches. And that's, I'm sure, I hope anyway, certainly a highlight. And that was something very cool. One of those like cool reporter moments, like, okay, I'm on the right track if I'm seeing this. That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been lucky enough. I've been following these rockets all over the place. They're coming up now from New Zealand and Alaska and the rainforest and everywhere. So, yeah, no, it's been fun.
Yeah, your Instagram feed must be the place to be. Lots of good stuff, I'm sure. Well, thank you so much, Ashley Vance, writer for Bloomberg Businessweek and author of Elon Musk, Tesla, SpaceX, and the Quest for a Fantastic Future. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
You bet. All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news, all that good stuff, back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. Hey there, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Always appreciate you sharing part of your afternoon with us. Lots to do on the program here in the second half. We, a little bit later, are going to be talking about the latest in the Lincoln Yard story. That's been a big one here in Chicago this week. So we're going to take a look at the latest and an editorial that was written about that at the Tribune. But right now we're joined by Helene Olin, opinion writer at Washington Post and author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Helene, welcome back to the program. Nice to talk with you again.
Oh, thank you for having me on.
So, you have written a column recently that is really interesting because it is about a book that's been out for a while, but it is taking a look at Elizabeth Warren's 2005 personal finance advice book and kind of seeing how it holds up now. Tell us about that and what sparked this writing it now, other than her being in the headlines for her presidential candidacy and all of that.
Well, last week was the 14th anniversary of the book's publication, and I should say the book was, it's now a bit forgotten, but it was actually a bestseller at the time. It was on the New York Times bestseller list, the Wall Street Journal, USA Today. And I wanted to go back and read the book and see how it reflected her concerns now, what she believed then, does she still believe it now? And I found it to be one of the more, I have to say, I've read it before. I read it, you know, about 10 years ago, originally. And I found it to be this really lovely, one of the most, as I put it, non-judgmental books of personal finance writing I've ever read, with this real understanding of what people were up against, right? And, you know, it sort of came out of her book, previous book, which is pretty well, which is fairly famous in policy circles, called The Two Income Trap, about how families found it increasingly hard to get ahead in today's economy, or in the 2003 economy, as the case may be, and how even sending a second person to work really didn't matter because the costs were outpacing the salary gains from that position. And in fact, that was leaving people in a worse position. And as part of that book, she had done a little bit of financial advice at the end that she co-wrote with her daughter, I should say. And that sort of took on a whole second life, and she began to do financial advice a la Susie Orman on the Dr. Phil show, this like whole segment of Elizabeth Warren's career that everybody's now forgotten about. And then she wrote this personal finance book. And in the first page, she says, you know, it's basically, she's like, you know, everything is stacked against you, but if you can follow this plan, you will be okay. So I got on the phone with her, and I basically said, do you still believe that, right? And her answer was, is that things have gotten much harder over the past 14 years.
And what specific things did she refer to being harder now?
That it was that, you know, costs like healthcare, housing, education had are still going up at, you know, more than inflation and more than people's salaries, which have remained stagnant for the most part. That at the same time, there were things in the book she was actually quite prescient about. And that included, you know, references to what became the housing crisis, where she talked about specifically flagging Wells Fargo for selling people junk mortgages loaded up with fees. And that, you know, that nobody was really helping anybody, right? And that was something that had also really increased dramatically, especially now in the Trump years.
And so in this piece that you wrote at Washington Post, and I'm going to be sure and tweet this out after the program so everyone listening can read it for themselves and share it and whatnot if they feel so inclined. But you mentioned kind of the three main schools of thought when it comes to approaching finances. And I wonder if you could talk about those a little bit and where this book in particular fits into those.
Yes. I opened the book by saying, as a long-term personal finance writer myself, I always say that there's three schools of personal finance thought, right? And the first is the get control of your daily expenses, give up the latte, right? You're wasting your money, and then you can save your money and put it in a 401k, and you will save for retirement. That's the famous latte factor, right? Or some Susie Orman. The second one is, frankly, what I would call the Robert Kiyosaki Donald Trump school, which is almost wealth, building, which is this idea that, it's not your problem is that you don't have enough money. And if you invest, you will be fine. The issue is, of course, a lot of the investments that get suggested by these people are fairly, dubious investments, flip houses, that sort of thing, right? And then the third school, and this is the one Elizabeth Warren is really in, says that the economy is not great for people. It is, the odds are stacked against you. The rules are not fair, but we have to live in the here and now. And this is the best plan I can come up with to protect you in this environment.
And where do you find, I feel like the first one is one that we hear a lot. And you've written so much about the finance industry. Where do you find most people approaching? Is it generally that first one, or are more people moving towards the third one? Or because where I'm going with this is, it seems like there is a kind of a social and political tie-in to each of these schools of thought, and I wonder if there's kind of a difference there of just kind of your worldview of where you land in these.
Right. I mean, probably the one that you hear the most, certainly on a day-to-day basis, is the first one, right? You're wasting your money on lattes. You can't afford a house because you ate out and got avocado toast, right? This is the stuff you hear on a daily basis. Often, by the way, said by people wearing $2,000 suits on television. It's always kind of mind-blowing to me that anybody takes that particularly seriously, but here we are as a society, right? The second one was very big prior to the crash, pre-2008, and it's still around. Certainly it was where Donald Trump came from, right? Trump University was a perfect example of the second one. This vaguely skanky, I'm going to teach you how to be rich by doing these investments with, and you just have to hand over your money to me, and I will teach you all the secrets, right? The third one is the one that is probably the most realistic. It's certainly when I do personal finance writing, still to this day, I fall in. But I have to say, it's probably the one that's hardest to get the message out there on, which is, this is an incredibly, screwed up system that we have, which is true, that, when income is not keeping up with expenses, you're fairly limited to some extent in what you can do. But here is how you can best protect yourself. And that's a hard one, because the fact of the matter is often people can't really protect themselves. Even Elizabeth Warren, kind of admits that, when I spoke to her, she barely had a section on student finances and student loans in her book, right, All Your Worth. And she said, if I was going to redo it now, I would do a huge section on that, because, of course, that was, that sort of came out of nowhere and just sort of boomed over the past decade and a half.
Right, right. Well, perhaps there's a second printing on the horizon, perhaps.
I asked her, and she said no.
I figured you would have. Yep, I figured you would have. Well, maybe she'll change her mind at some point. So because you read this first and then reread it more recently, about a decade later, as you said, what surprised you about rereading it that maybe didn't stick out to you that first time?
I think what surprised me the most was the real non-judgmental language she used. Because so much of personal finance advice is scolding. You're either being castigated for your small sins, the latte, the avocado toast, the vacation you shouldn't have taken, or you're being scolded because you're simply not, flipping houses, investing in gold, fill in the blank. And, she really kind of understood where people were coming from. And to me, that was what really leaped out at me. She really felt her people that she spoke to. And she felt the pain of their decisions, and she didn't blame them for their decisions. And she understood why, in many cases, they had gotten into such financial trouble. And this is something that would seem like common sense, that you would think this would be in any financial book. But in fact, or any financial column, or any financial website, or blog post, or Instagram personality, right? But in fact, it's so rarely there. And to me, it was just this abundance of empathy is the only way I could put it.
Mm, well, indeed, anything that's inspiring conversation around so many of the financial issues that so many people have found themselves in, I think is probably a good thing, no matter where you fall politically. I think we can all agree more empathy is always needed. Well, thank you so much, Helene Olin, opinion writer at Washington Post and author of Pound Foolish, Exposing the Dark Side of the Personal Finance Industry. Appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Certainly. All right, we're going to take a little break, and when we come back, we are going to be talking about a Chicago Tribune editorial board piece about Lincoln Yards. That's a story that's been happening like a lot this week has been in the news in Chicago, so we're going to take a look at the latest back in just a bit here on 720 WGN. WGN. It's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks so much for being with us today. So, for those of you who have been following the news this week and for the last few months, really, but especially this week, I'm sure you have been seeing the Lincoln Yard story. Lots of conversation, a lot of angst, a lot of feelings, a lot of stuff going on around this proposed development of Lincoln Yards. And a lot of people have been writing about it and covering it and doing a lot of things to keep people informed. And one of those people is Ryan Ory, who is a columnist covering commercial real estate at Chicago Tribune, who joins us now for the latest on that story. Welcome to the program. Always a pleasure to talk with you, Ryan.
Hi, how are you?
Great. Thanks for joining us today. So what is the latest on Lincoln Yards? I feel like it's been kind of a tense week. There was one hurdle kind of cleared, and I think that reignited a lot of a lot of activists have been working in this space. A lot of business leaders are in support of it. There's just a lot of stuff here, and it's a big story here in our city. So where does it stand at this moment?
Yeah, so Lincoln Yards, for anyone who hasn't been paying attention, is a proposed $6 billion development along the Chicago River, but kind of along the edge of Lincoln Park and Bucktown. And it's been in the works for some time, but now the plan has kind of been accelerating toward gaining the zoning approval from the city that's needed. This week, there was change to the plan announced on Tuesday that the developer Sterling Bay agreed to double the amount of affordable housing units that would be part of the project up to 600. It had been 300. And then a couple days later, on the day the city council's zoning committee was set to vote on it, there was another change announced that there was a reduction of the tallest buildings from 650 feet down to 595 feet and a reduction of 500,000 total square feet of the entire project. So, and then the zoning committee approved the plan, and it kind of moved it close to a city council vote and ultimately being able to proceed.
And so that's where it's at right now. And here we have, we have this mayoral election runoff happening. And I understand that both of them, both candidates, Lori Lightfoot and Tony Preckwinkle, have both expressed, hey, can we put the brakes on this for a minute until we can get in there and get our heads around it and get going and to see whoever is the winner of this runoff. What is the timeline now? I feel like the mayoral runoff has complicated the timeline a bit.
Yeah, there have been several sort of mega developments in the works in Chicago, and this one, for whatever reason, has really wound up kind of in the crosshairs of the the mayoral runoff election that's coming up. This one's kind of gotten all the attention in terms of how the zoning process works and what role the mayor plays in it. And, you know, there have been accusations that, you know, Sterling Bay is trying to hurry this across the finish line. While Rahm Emanuel is still the mayor, he's regarded as very, you know, pro-business and pro-development and likes to get these kind of projects done. And there's kind of the unknown of the two candidates in the runoff are you know, had kind of spoken out about and said, slow this process down, and they've questioned some aspects of the plan. And I think from Sterling Bay's perspective, it'd be better just to get this wrapped up and not wait and see what the unknown is. Developers don't like unknowns, and particularly when you're doing a $6 billion project. And so that's kind of the subplot to all this, all the zoning maneuvering that's happening.
Right. And it seems like it's been really interesting to just kind of watch this story on social media and just in the way people are, as you said, this is in the crosshairs, not just of the mayoral discussion, but I think in the push-pull and kind of this tug-of-war between, you know, business and activists and business leaders, rather, and activists and how that's going. Where are these kind of two competing narratives right now in terms of people that are opposing this and then people that are supporting it? I think the support one seems fairly straightforward. It's mostly about bringing new business and expanding, you know, further urbanizing, you know, this area and expanding the city and the business footprint. And what is the activist space and the people opposing this? What is the kind of the line there?
There have been a couple aspects of it. One of them has been that, you know, there has been compromise by the developer, and now they're up to create 600 affordable units out of 6,000 total apartments or condos that would be developed there. That would be the largest amount of affordable housing that's ever been created from the city's affordable housing ordinance. And so it's a huge amount of affordable units, but there's also a lot of people who don't like the way the ordinance is set up, because Sterling Bay also has the option to meet its obligations as far as affordable housing goes by moving some of the affordable units off-site and also paying some fees. And you know, they're following the rules that are in place, but a lot of people don't like it. And because of this huge size of the project, it's drawn a lot of attention, whereas previous projects where people have paid the fees or moved some of the affordable off-site really haven't. And then there's the timing of it has also raised a lot of objections. Alderman Brian Hopkins, whose ward this is in and who's overseeing this process, has argued that this... He's been having public meetings on this for years, and even before he was elected, he was working on what was going to happen to all this formerly industrial land. And he argues that he's had dozens of meetings with various groups and that he's got this in the position it needs to be in and it should move forward. Other people are saying they should wait until there's a new mayor and some new city council members, and they should have a chance to weigh in. You know, again, the alderman has argued, you know, there's no sense in waiting just for the sake of waiting. Why should we wait just to wait? And he's said, if there's specific things that people object to, let's hear them now. But just to wait until there's a new mayor just for the sake of waiting, he's kind of, you know, just kind of said that's not necessary. So, you know, and again, the opponents are saying, what's the rush? It's been going on. They've been planning this a long time. Why not wait, you know, a couple more months and see what happens with the political situation?
Right. It's also been really interesting to watch people rally around some small businesses that would be impacted by this. In particular, the Hideout, I think, was one of the first ones. You know, this wonderful small music venue that's been part of the city for a very long time. It's been fascinating to watch people rally around that. And that's been kind of this, what I think brought a lot of people to the Lincoln Yards project, right? The people that probably otherwise wouldn't really, you know, this wouldn't be on their radar. They wouldn't take much interest into, a commercial real estate development. Suddenly it's like, oh, wait, this is about the Hideout. And it really, I think, brought a lot of people into this conversation that otherwise wouldn't have been. And I think that's been pretty fascinating, too.
Yeah, I think probably to the chagrin of Sterling Bay, virtually every aspect of this plan that as it's come out has sort of unexpectedly caught the attention of various groups and created backlash that maybe they didn't anticipate. And as far as the Hideout goes, there was a previous version of this plan that had a 20,000 seat soccer stadium and several other smaller venues that would have been operated in a partnership with Live Nation. And Live Nation is viewed, very skeptically by these small independent venues that say they, they kind of want to have a monopoly on the market and so on and so forth. And so a lot of these smaller venues rallied together and objected, and eventually those aspects of the plan were scrapped. But even after that's happened, they've still sort of rallied against it and still continued to protest the potential use of TIF funding. And also they called for, the process to slow down and other things. And, the Hideout has sort of presented itself as, we're going to get swallowed up and by this giant project right next to us, and we're going to be forced out. Now, they own their property, so to me, it's not entirely clear how they would be forced out, but I do think they just feel like this massive project is about to happen on their doorstep, and this kind of quirky, small venue is about to have this behemoth as a neighbor, and that's struck a chord with a lot of people.
Yeah, it really has, I think, and it's kept people, as you said, kept people in this conversation. If nothing else, I think, kind of in a bigger way, at least the way we will look back on this in the history books, I think this Lincoln Yards project has got a lot of people, it's got a lot of people talking about aspects of politics and affordable housing and small business ownership and big business and in new ways. And I think at the very least, that's if there is a silver lining, to all this consternation that people are going through for this project, I think maybe that's it. And it's really interesting. And so I appreciate voices like yours out there in this conversation, keeping people informed. And we'll keep turning to you for the latest. Thanks for being with us today. Ryan Ory.
My pleasure.
Columnist covering commercial real estate at Chicago Tribune. Thanks so much, Ryan. Appreciate you.
Sure.
All right. We're going to take a little break and get you to news. All the good stuff back in just a bit here on 720 WGN.